in the last sort of 18 to 24 months, the big boys and girls were the first to withdraw their cash, but now they're the first to get it back in. If you look at the KKRs of the world, the Blackstones, they've made some massive portfolio bets in multifamily. It's a signal that multifamily is here to stay for the long term.
Welcome to Investing in the US, a podcast for real estate investors, business owners, and aspiring entrepreneurs looking to grow their wealth by investing in US real estate. I'm your host, Reid Goossens, and so far, I've acquired over $800 million worth of investments on various properties across the United States. On this podcast, I interview go-getters, risk-takers, and the best in the business to learn more about their investment journey and the cutting-edge strategies they are applying towards building a legacy. For more on growing your own wealth and by investing in the US, visit www.reidgoossens.com.
I'm your host, Tyler Lyons, and I'm very excited for today's guest. He's a real estate entrepreneur, investor, and author who began investing in U.S. real estate in 2012. Since then, he's co-founded two multifamily private equity firms, acquiring over $800 million in real estate. He also hosts the Investing in U.S. podcast, and he's a longtime friend of the show and friend of mine as well. Reid Goossens, welcome back to the show.
G'day, mate. Thanks for having me on.
Really excited to dive into you here today, Reid. We're going to have a little bit of a current state of the market conversation here today. And there's many different directions we can take this conversation. I'm super excited to have you on the show today and pick your brain. So let's start kind of broad on that conversation here today, Reid. We can go a bit deeper from there. When you kind of step back and look at it from a 10,000 foot level, how would you characterize the current market environment right now in multifamily? You know, are we in a buyer's market? Are we in a seller's market? Is a bit more balanced. Yep. Like, how would you kind of characterize the state of the market right now?
Yeah, you can quote me on this. I think we've hit the bottom. Like, I think if you take even a further step back, I think the last 10 years, you mentioned I've been involved in multifamily since 2012. It's been a euphoric run. And we've gone through our first real turbulence, right? And in the last, pretty much since 2022. But I think we've seen the worst of it. Now, the big question is going to be, are we going to drag along the bottom for a little bit, or are we going to start to come off the bottom? And depending, you know, we don't know, we'll have a crystal ball, but I know what, for me, I thought we were going to starting to come out of it when we saw the rate cuts and the treasuries start to really drop. Then all of a sudden, they just go up 80 basis points again. So it's a little bit of turbulence. We're coming around to end, it's being recorded at the end of 2024. But we've gone through, you know, there was a saying back in 2022, when they started the rate hiking cycle, survive to 25. Well, 25 is literally around the corner. We, as you know as well, because we partnered up on a couple of deals, we've been buying throughout that time. And depending on what markets you're in, there've been some fantastic buying opportunities. But big picture, I think it is a buying opportunity. Where we've come from a very high octane type of world of thinking about performers in a certain way. And there's been a lot of black swan events that have added to, you know, added to the froth, right? And we can get into that, you know, why and some of the lessons I've learned, you know, in the last sort of 3 or 4 years since COVID, and how that shaped my investment thesis moving forward.
Yeah, let's do that. That's kind of, let's take the conversation there if you don't mind. So do you kind of reflect on, you know, we kind of saw the multifamily market get exceptionally hot in 2021 and early 2022, when you kind of step back and reflect on some of the market factors that were at play during that point in time, what would you kind of attribute to a lot of that kind of quote unquote market froth to? Like, what really were the drivers behind that big run up that we saw during that period of time?
I think that, again, take one step back, there's been multiple contributions to that froth, right? And we start way back in 2012, what happened? The Jobs Act happened. People, the average Joe could start investing directly with sponsors, right? It wasn't country club deals. That was a very big catalyst. And what you and I have grown up and cut our teeth on has been a euphoric, hey, let's jump into this world, right? Add on top of that, which we'll talk about in a little bit, tech and why that's important in this conversation. We can come back to it. I remember, and I spoke on a panel this last week where I saw you out in Phoenix. It was great to see you. The coolest thing since sliced bread back in the day was getting an investor to sign with DocuSign. Now, what has tech done in the last 10 years? Real estate investing or commercial real estate, there's been the adding of the Jobs Act, a lot of people wanting to place their money directly to sponsors. That is also added, and it was ripe for a lot of tech to be overlaid on top of that. What does tech do? It reduces the ambiguity. So think of like a rent survey that you call around and you find out what all the rents are. That was a manual process back in the day. Today, it's a click of a button. You can find out what a studio rents for, what a one-bedroom rents for, and you can get a comp slash P&L pretty easily today. So that's the second thing that I'll add. The third thing I'll add is obviously COVID was a huge black swan,
yeah.
Right? And then that then required stimulus. I'm not getting political, but that then meant a lot of money in the street, and that meant a lot of people had money in their pockets, and that added to the froth. Right. I think from the lessons that I took away is not only COVID, not only interest rate hikes, not only all that stuff, but also looking at a P&L and making investment decisions in that frothy time when people had extra money in their pocket. And what do I mean by that? Well, looking at a rent roll and saying, I now can charge $1,800 on a $1,400 unit rent, where it was always supposed to be $1,400. It's just because the stimulus checks had kept that sort of the buoyancy going. And so I think where a lot of people got caught was trying to compete and get deals done, looking at a rent roll with blinkers on and saying, this is what the new rent's going to be, and not really thinking, what happens when the stimulus stops? What happens when interest rates start to rise? What happens when that short-term debt starts to come due? That was the perfect storm. So you have, you know, the Jobs Act, you have tech, you have COVID, you have stimulus, you have a rent hiking cycle. It has all been one, you know, perfect storm to really throw a lot of choppy waters our way. And there's been a lot of sponsors who are handing back keys today, and not newbie sponsors. I'm talking about big guys who know who just said it's not worth the paper it's written on. You know, we'll see you later. Here are the keys. So we can unpack a lot there, Tyler. But that's sort of my two cents of where you could take a 30,000 view of where we've come from the last 10 years. And I will say the next 10 years won't be the same as the last 10 years.
Yeah, great perspective there. And definitely agree with your point of view too, in terms of what drove a lot of that froth and some really good learnings that you were able to tease out of that process too. And it's kind of interesting during that period when we saw that stimulus, it wasn't just the investor side that was kind of driving the froth as the consumer side too, right? You had consumer frothiness because you had people with extra money in their pocket. They're moving out, they're getting their own place. It's kind of artificially pushing up that multifamily demand for units. That's pushing up rent. Then the investor side too, you've got LPs who are looking to invest, sponsors trying to be aggressive to get deals done, to get equity placed. And then on top of it, you had rock bottom interest rates at that point in time. And like you alluded to, interest rates came back up, and it's been a bit of a rude awakening for many people. That definitely is a good synopsis of kind of where we were and some of your learnings there. When you kind of look ahead here, Reed, when you look at like the next, call it short to midterm here, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, is there anything in particular that you're going to be monitoring closely? You know, whether it's economic indicators or signals you might be looking for, certain multifamily fundamentals you might be looking at. Looking ahead, like what do you think the most important things are that we should be paying attention to?
I think from an interest rate perspective, it's definitely around the Fed's, how quickly they're cutting. And now with the incoming president, I think the market has factored that in. Does that mean there's less rate cuts next year? Maybe. You know, I was seeing a time in summer 2025 where we could maybe have 150 basis points off the federal fund rate.
Yeah.
That was really like, wow, if you got that, I think it would bring a lot more people, you know, back into a very, very stagnant market that we've seen. You know, sales year over year are down 80% in the multifamily space. I don't know if that's going to happen as quickly, but again, if you look back at history, rate increasing went really, really quickly, or fairly quickly. And 9 times out of 10, that rate cutting cycle also happens just as quickly. So I'm really looking closely at the job creations. We've just come out of, I didn't see the last month, but I think the month prior, we had 9 or 12,000 jobs with Hurricane Helene involved in that, plus Boeing's strike. Mm-hmm. Anything under 100,000 on a monthly basis is technically classed as negative job loss because of the birth rate. So very much looking at that. And they always revise those numbers down. I think, you know, you can follow very, very, really smarter guy than I am. JP Coughlin, I think his name is, over at the Rate Guy podcast. Very, very big shout out to him. He's into all those numbers, but I follow him, and he has some very good data on like where we're at. I do think as a multifamily operator, we are at the coal face, I should say, because when our class C plus B minus tenants start to struggle with rent, I personally believe we've been in more of a recession for a lot, you know, probably for at least 18 months. when you look at the delinquencies across our portfolio in those secondary markets, in that workforce housing, and that is an indication that, you know, we're all paying the same for gas, we're all paying the same for milk. So looking at those delinquencies, I will say, sitting here, we were just talking in the green room before we press record, and we're across a couple of assets in Phoenix. Phoenix got hit really hard. And I would say Phoenix, out of all the markets we were have invested in, the cap rate on purchase prices pretty much was in lockstep with the interest rate increases with the Fed. So we closed on the Tallows. We closed on the Lennox. We closed those. That was April last year and September last year. You know, remember the peak was in 2022. So less than a year later, we're buying those things at high five caps. Where at the peak, they would have traded for a mid four cap, even a low four cap, right? So just how quickly that expanded, and we were able to pick up a really good buys and then get positive leverage on that from day one. It was very, very interesting. We have seen some stagnant rent growth in places like Phoenix because of supply, but we have seen that supply being absorbed. And I would say, looking at our portfolio, like we discussed, guess where we are today? And this is coming to the slowest time of the year, which is Christmas and Thanksgiving. We're full on all our properties. Delinquency is down. It was up. So I'm starting to see actually more positive signs. Now, if I look at another market like Austin, I've got about 1,000 units down in Austin. It's not kind of the same scenario. I was talking to my business partner down there. They're still in the mid-80s to high 80s in terms of occupancy. Delinquency is still a problem. So I think Phoenix has gone through the worst of it from a class C, B plus type of, you know, rental market. But say Austin, on the other hand, which is also the golden child of, you know, market reports, it was always Phoenix and Austin. It still seems to be going through it if you just look at the data on individual 1980s, 1990s workforce housing. So I can't say that that market is maybe hit the bottom yet. But if we just look at the data and feel what I've been feeling operating these assets, it feels like, one, we've been in a recession for longer. Two, in a place like Phoenix, we seem to have hit the bottom. And then three, depending on where you are in terms of investment areas, how those quote-unquote recovery is happening right now.
Yeah, all great points there, Reed. There's a lot to unpack there, and I have so many questions for you. You had mentioned, you know, in terms of the transaction environment and transactions being down pretty significantly. Totally agree with that. We're definitely seeing that in a pretty big way in Phoenix right now. Just not a ton to go around in terms of deals. But one thing that's kind of been interesting is that it seems like it's a bit of a bifurcated market, where, you know, for the new builds, the bigger, more institutional quality properties, we've still seen a decent amount of transaction volume happening kind of at the highest end of the market. But then for smaller, older, scrappier properties, there's just been hardly anything happening. What have you seen from that perspective? Have you experienced a similar phenomenon in markets that you're operating in?
Yep. And I will also say that the average syndication these days, the average sort of middle markets deal is now worth more, right? So it's trying to raise capital on. I remember when I was, my first deal was 192 units, and it was a $15 million deal, right? Today, that same deal is probably worth $35 million, right? Like, it's harder to get these deals done in a, you know, 10 years later, because you've got to go raise money. So to your point, yes, I think there's one thing I'll say is that in the last sort of 18 to 24 months, the market, the big boys and girls were the first to withdraw their cash, but now they're the first to get it back in. If you look at the KKRs of the world, the Blackstones, they've made some massive portfolio bets in multifamily. Yes, Class A. Yes, you know, destination cities, Boston, Miami, New York, all those sort of stuff. But it's a signal that multifamily is here to stay for the long term. Let's see how NMHC goes. Because right now, I was just talking to a broker who you'd probably know, Cliff David. Big shout out to Cliff. Probably one of the smartest brokers I know in the Phoenix markets. He is saying it's eerily quiet right now in Phoenix. So from a transactional volume, you know, and he was just giving some stats to me the other day, and I don't know if you're all about Phoenix, but you're in Phoenix, I'm in Phoenix, you might as well just quickly talk about it. At the peak, I believe he said there was 150 transactions, or maybe it was 150, around 150 for the calendar year of 2022. The average transactions is around 70 or 80, right, on average over 20 years. We're only at 40 transactions year to date. So still well below the average. And he's like, that was even, and he thinks, you know, he was even saying that it was very similar to last year, 2023. He's like, I think 2025 becomes better, but I don't know if we get back to our average. I think we're just ticking up, you know, on the current, you know, maybe get to 60 transactions next year. So it depends on who you speak to. And again, I think that's all tied to the Fed interest rates. We see more cuts in the Fed interest rates. I think it's going to have more people jumping back in the pool. And I think it's going to paper over a lot of cracks. And, 10 years later, we'll be like, oh, how good was that? We rode out that downturn. But, maybe the Fed saved everyone's ass.
Right. Yeah. And again, a lot to unpack there. When you look at, you kind of mentioned earlier, some of the supply and some of these markets, you'd mentioned Austin still a bit, vacancy still running a bit higher there. Phoenix, we're kind of starting to turn the corner a little bit. It's starting to look a little bit better in Phoenix now. And it's been kind of interesting. We've seen just kind of knockout crazy absorption numbers in many of these markets right now. And that gives me a lot of hope that the market is still robust and things are looking good. But in the market that we've been operating in the last couple of years here, it's been a little bit different. When you look at 2019, 2020, 2021, people were happy to buy property and, reduce occupancy, renovate units and push rents, right? But we've been operating in this environment the last couple of years here where, heads and beds has been the name of the game, being very careful about monitoring your occupancy, managing your occupancy, making sure it doesn't get too low, because then it's going to be really tough to recover in a difficult environment. So when it comes to something like managing tenant retention in this kind of environment, what have you been doing? Like, what kind of advice or kind of tips and tricks might you have for people to really make sure that you manage your tenant retention right now in this environment?
Yeah, well, again, speaking from where we've come from. So I remember the day, early 2023, on an asset management call, and rents dropped $300 overnight in certain parts of and this is really across Texas, Phoenix, Carolinas. And I'm just like, what is going on? And you looked into it and we talked about back to the stimulus money. When stimulus stopped, it took a couple of months to bleed through, and then boom, overnight, month free, 2 months free. The supply probably also had a lot to do with it. And so it was a very much a, and then a couple on the other side, the high delinquency. So then you had markets like Phoenix where you can get rid of evict people quite quickly. Then you had this bit of a cesspool going on because the next person coming through the door couldn't qualify because they're evicted, right? Yeah. So you now have this, you had this weird turn, like merry-go-round for about 12 months where it was like you're trying to get people and you had a lot of tours, but not everyone was qualified. So, back to the question was like, how do you manage it? It was a real lesson in not only where rental rates needed to drop to find a floor, which I believe we have done in, say, a market like Phoenix, but also how, like, you've got to be on it. Like, and you can't just be on the leasing side and not the delinquency side, or delinquency side, not the leasing side. It's really a combination of both. Yeah. And having a very good property manager, having AI tools, if you do use AI, to help you drive home and collect those rents, but also get, heads in bed. So not one magic wand that just does it all. I think it's a concoction of a lot of things. And as well as we do, look, we've had to shift some property managements in the last 12 months, which is, we can get into that as well, but that ultimately is bakes the success of your property. And hopefully the market, gives you a bit of a boost as well.
Absolutely. And definitely hold the thought on AI tools. I definitely want to circle back on that with you here today, Reed, for sure. Kind of going back to kind of the market environment and what's looking like right now. How about the interest rate environment right now? I guess a couple of questions on that in terms of, like, how do you view the interest rate environment? Like, where do you think we go from here? But then kind of a secondary part of it, how are you thinking about it from a debt execution standpoint? Like, what are you guys looking to do from that perspective?
Yeah, again, I love to map out where we've come over the years. So beginning of the year, we were probably in the high fives, low sixes in terms of agency debt. So take SOFA, which was at, about a five, add a spread of about 130 bips, you'd get to, the five-year treasury. That's what we were underwriting to. Then all of a sudden it dropped like a rock, and we're like, woohoo, we're in the low five categories. Like, we're starting to get positive leverage from day one. This is freaking fantastic. And there was ways that I mentioned earlier on the two deals we did, we were able to buy that positive leverage, so you are day one, even if the treasuries weren't there. But now it's kind of gone back up to yeah, high fives again. And I'm involved in a deal right now where we're negotiating on, and we underwrote that at a 5.25 base interest rate, and we're not going to get 5.25 interest rate. So I'm nervous, right, on where we can go, and it's going to have to be a conversation with the seller. Like, this is outside of my control. right? If treasuries go up 80 basis points, I can't pay whatever, a 5.5 cap or a 6 cap for it. I've got to pay more. It just doesn't, the numbers don't work. So you've got to be very careful and keep your finger on the pulse as deals are transacting, because you need to be adjusting your assumptions in real time. So I think the lesson learned over the last 12 months is it's a constant education every week, every month, to see, like, okay, hey, Mr. Debt Broker, where are you seeing things pricing at today? And the easiest way to go do that is look at the five-year treasury, particularly on agency, and add about a 130 basis point spread is ballpark, maybe 140. That's really your all-in rate is what's going to be. So you might have been underwritten to a 5.25. Well, I already know today the 5 years not going to be there. I can even tell you what the 5 years and add the spread on top of that. You're going to be in the mid to high fives, and maybe the deal doesn't pencil at the original number that you were looking to acquire it at.
That's so true. And just something that I can relate to in such a big way right now. Hunter and I looking at deals together and seeing the treasury yields changing and just having to deal with it. And it's interesting, Reed, because I feel like if rates were high, it would be one thing. If rates were consistently high, or if rates were consistently lower, that'd be another thing. I think the thing that's tripping a lot of people up right now, including myself, is just the simple volatility, just mm-hmm. how much it's been bouncing around and up and down, you know. And it's when you just don't have stable treasury yields and they're all over the place, it makes it really hard to transact and do business in the multifamily space. So it's something that we've all been fighting and dealing with. And on that point, Reed, you know, I know when it comes to the topic of retrading, it's one of those things that it was something that was almost kind of taboo historically, is kind of just like, hey, look, you just never retrade, you know, just don't do it. But it feels like in this day and age, maybe the sentiment on doing that sort of stuff has changed a little bit. So when it comes to something like interest rates, and you alluded to, like, holy cow, interest rates have changed 80 basis points since we tied this deal up. How do you think about that? Is it a delicate retrade conversation, or what does that look like for you guys?
Yeah, look, I think to your point, it's sentiment has changed. Like, I'm literally looking at the 5 year today. We tied up a deal in June, where it was the treasuries were, maybe it was even a little bit in June, the treasuries were, the 5 year treasury was 4.5%, right? So we probably would have done a 5.75 interest rate, you know, just based on that. We didn't end up closing on that deal till late August, and we ended up getting a sub 5 interest rate. Now, I've been doing this for 10 years, Tyler, and I have never, ever, 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 ever had the markets work in my favor. So this was a huge hooray.
But we'll take it.
So back in June, it was 5.45. It bottomed out in September at 3.42. So that's over 100 basis point swing. That's in end of September. Now we're back up at 4.3. So we've gone from 3.42 at the bottom. Again, nearly 90 basis point swing in October, 2 months. It's huge volatility. Like, that's just, you can't. And the sellers know that. The brokers now know that. I think the biggest thing is the brokerage world, it was so taboo to talk about it. Now they're like, if they're worth their salt, like, come on, dude. Like, we're all looking at the same freaking thing here. It's math at the end of the day. Like, I just can't pay. Oh, we're going to go find another buyer. It's like, they're going to have to pay the same as what we're going to have to pay. So right. The treasuries is one thing that's obviously very, and for those, you know, newer investors, it's one thing you can have a pretty good, you know, you understand where it's going to pencil out. But with volatility, you don't have it locked until you have it locked. So you might go tie up a deal. It might take you 30 days to get your application in with Freddie or Fannie. They might say, okay, great. Now you can go rate lock. Within those 30 days, treasuries can change. And that's the risk that sellers and buyers have to take. Now, if they start shifting too much, like we just mentioned, 100 basis points, that's when you think, need to start saying, time out. I can't pay you the 5.5 cap anymore. I need to pay a 6 cap.
Makes sense. So, yeah, because at the end of the day, too, I mean, if you tied up a deal and you're in the process of raising capital, you know, maybe you've marketed a 15.9% internal rate of return to investors, and now interest rates have changed, and it's like, holy cow, it's shaved a whole point off of the returns now. Maybe I'm 14.9 or 14.5 or something like that. So I don't know if you've been, like, in this exact situation before, but let's say you tie a property up, treasuries change like crazy. You're able to negotiate a modest reduction in price, but you've got to go back to investors and say, hey, look, I know we talked about 15.9, but it's 15.1 right now. Have you been in that situation? Yeah. And if so, like, how do you manage that sort of conversation with investors?
Yeah, look, it's the part of doing business, right? You back to, like, these deals take 60 to 90 days to close, right? You've set a pro forma and got the thing under contract based on a snapshot in time 60 days prior. Things might change over time. And it just, you know, investors understand that, right? And 9 times out of 10, when you have those retrade conversations, you're not going to get every cent on the dollar, right? That, you know, hey, treasuries have moved 50 basis points. I need $1 million reduction. You might end up meeting somewhere in the middle, you know, 750, 500,000, where they've had to take some concessions, you've had to take them some concessions. And hopefully you've gone through DD and you've uncovered more juice that you can squeeze out of the apple. And that's, I think, the, hey, interest rates have increased. We've got a bit of a retrade, but guess what? We've also found that there's, you know, still a fantastic deal, still really solid returns. You know, are you in? So there's different things, different levers you can pull on. We've had to drop a deal recently, and we can talk about that are based on some fraud on the P&L, but I'm not going to name the deal, but there's just stuff is happening in real time that sellers are so desperate to get things off their books that they're willing to do anything to make the deal look with the most rose-tinted glasses. And when you get in there and you find out that it's not the right thing, then sometimes you have to walk away. And we've had to walk away recently on one deal, which is a shame, but actually, as of today, it might be coming back around at even cheaper price than we even anticipated. So you never know. Things you stick around the hoop, you'll get a rebound.
That's super interesting. And certainly not going to ask you to disclose anything that's confidential here. But in terms of how you identified that particular issue, how did you identify that there was potentially fraud on the top line? Was it a matter of like taking the financials back to tax returns, or what was the
other? Yeah, it was G&L versus P&L. And balance sheet. So looking at your G&L, general ledger, balance sheet, and P&L, we already knew going into the deal there wasn't any bad debt. And we're like, hang on, where's the bad debt? So we negotiated the PSA with some sort of guardrails in place. You need to have a certain amount of delinquency and you need to be a certain amount of occupied.
Sure.
Then when we got the financials in DD, all of a sudden, there's these bad debt lines that started popping up. Mm. And there was multiple six figures. And we're like, whoa, that's not what we underwrote to. This we cannot pay this for this deal. Lo and behold, we had to walk away from over six figures of not hard money, but just, you know, marketing costs, time, all that stuff, legal bills, and we had to walk away from the deal. So it does happen. You keep your eyes open, guys, and this is not the first time I've heard of things being a little shady.
Absolutely. And kind of back to the interest rate discussion and debt execution discussion, from a debt execution perspective, is there anything that you guys are trying to do right now? Like, what do you think makes the most sense? Is it long-term fixed rate agency finance?
Yeah.
What are you guys trying to do there?
We've only done agency since March of 2022, right? Fixed rate, only done that. There has been some murmurs about, you know, as we saw the treasuries dropping, like, oh, hang on, we're in a rate cutting cycle. Maybe it makes more sense. We've got investors saying maybe you should get a floater. And now that we're starting to see it pop back up again, I'm glad we're sticking with the guns. Positive leverage day one, fixed rate interest rates. Even if interest rates come down over the next 5 years, you've got that positive leverage and some sort of story of, adding some value. And, Tyler, we're involved in a couple of deals in Phoenix and we had positive leverage from day one and the things are cash flowing great. They're full. And that's how you're supposed to buy real estate. And I think that's where, going back to 2021, 2022, people buying with negative leverage, which, you know, for those people out there, means you're going in interest rates higher than your cap rate, and you're hoping that the rent growth is going to pop your head out of water and you're going to be all good. Well, then also goes back to that stimulus check we mentioned. And if you're underwriting rents at $1,800 and they drop to $1,400, which has happened, you might be a little screwed. So,
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Is there anything a bit more nuanced that you're looking to do from a debt execution perspective? Like, how do you think, for example, about like buy down provisions and that sort of
100%. Thing? 100%. Or buy downs for me are easy money. And what a buy down is you're fronting the interest to get a lower note rate. So you might be coming in at, say, 5.5% interest rate. The particularly agencies can allow you to essentially 200 grand, they might say, here's 200 grand. I'm going to buy that down 15 basis points. So now my all-in rate is, you know, 535. And over a five-year period, that lower interest rate fixed will actually give you more cash flow than the upfront fee that it costs you to buy it down. The other thing we do is affordability, natural affordability. Most 1980s, 1990s, 2000 product are below the AMI standards that are set by Freddie and Fannie. So you can go shave a couple of basis points off their spread in order to, you know, again, reduce your interest rate and create that positive leverage from day one.
What about on the prepay side? Is it worth it to do kind of like a step down prepay or something like that? Or how do you guys think about
it? Step down prepay. Well, I think it's good if you're thinking about selling prior to 5 years, right? Mm. I think we're in a slower recovery market. And I think most of the deals, as I've mentioned to your investors and my investors, we're going to be in it for the long haul. Like, I think we've changed this, the way in which real estate was treated. You sell it in 2 years, you double people's money. And I've done that. I look like a freaking champion. Whoop-de-doo, pat myself on the back. But in history, you look back, real estate's a medium to long-term game. And I think we're just going back to that. Positive leverage day one, you're going to be buying it for 5 to 6 years. Put it on the shelf. Don't worry about it. It's going to cash flow and we're going to continue to grow rents. Because what we are coming out of a market, Tyler, as you know, that rental growth looks a little stagnant over the next couple of years. So I just don't think there's going to be opportunity to really grow your NOI really aggressively and then get a bigger number in 3 years' time that you want to flip out of it then. There might be, and I'm happy to be proven wrong, but I'm telling my investors, look, we're going to be in it for the full 5 year hold, you know, brace yourself for that. And that's how I'm just got my, and I, look, maybe my lens will change, but for right now, I'm not looking at sort of, I'd rather get that the best interest rate and then create the most positive spread. And if I'm doing a step down prepay, typically those interest rates are higher than the fixed. So you're going to pay for it somewhere, whether you pay for this, you know, at the front, you pay for it on the back end with less prepay, you know, or you just hold for 5 years. You don't have any prepay issues. So it's a sort of evolution of a conversation that we have internally at RSM.
Yeah, it's such great points there. And I agree with you too. I like the idea of investing in multifamily when it's about buying, owning and operating good real estate and generating yield and cash flow. It's just, to me, it feels like the most responsible way to go about the business. And yeah, when things really heated up back in 2021, 2022, there's a lot of kind of fixing and flipping going on. And, you know, it's good to see the industry does seem like it's kind of going back to the fundamentals of buy, own, operate, generate cash flow that way. And I like your perspective too, around just being conservative and careful in terms of your expectations around net operating income growth. You know, it's kind of interesting because sometimes you hear people talk about multifamily investing and say, hey, look, you know, it's a hedge against inflation because, you know, as inflation goes up, your rents go up. And you hear some of these conversations around rent growth and net operating income growth. And I think it requires a bit more of a nuanced approach to think about it, because if you are operating in an inflationary environment, you might be in a situation where maybe your operating expenses are going up because of inflation. Right. But at the same time, let's say you're in a market where you're experiencing some higher supply. Look, your rent growth might be stagnating a bit. Right. So because you have inflation, it doesn't necessarily mean that net operating income is going to expand. I think it's a bit more of a nuanced topic than that. But what do you say about it? What do you think, Reed?
That's been the number one thing that we're getting whacked with. Right. Rents are down. Inflation's massively ripped through our operating expense, operating budget. And you got insurance pricing that is up. So, and interest rates are up. So it's like, the cost of doing business, that margin is razor thin. So I also think there's a come to Jesus moment of this is a, again, how much cash flow is there really in the first 2 years? And it's probably needing to be modeled more realistically. And that's where investors need to probably change their mindset around. Again, I've been doing this for 10 years. I remember buying deals and you were cash flowing out of the gate 8% from day one. It was fantastic. You know, you're buying at 6 caps and you had interest rates of 4.5, 150 basis point spread. It was freaking beautiful. That doesn't happen as much anymore, right? Because again, everything I mentioned earlier, the lane's extremely busy. The jobs act changed. People know that you can, how to operate deals. Tech has really just reduced the ambiguity in all these deals. And then obviously low interest rates. So I think in general, I feel more squeezed than ever as an operator to constantly have to battle some fires around expense growth and keeping it down, and because my rent growth isn't going to be there. So what we are looking for, like I just did an exercise the other day on a tax abatement deal in Greenville, South Carolina that we own, and we literally went through it line by line and checked again 60% AMI, 80% AMI, and the market rent. Well, the truth be told, even the 80% AMI from HUD is higher on a two-bedroom property, a two-bedroom apartment, than what we could achieve in the market. And we just literally went through into this an analysis just to see, like, if you just brought it up to the peak of a 60% AMI or brought up to the peak of what we think market is, there was still some really significant rent growth. I'm talking like 8 or 9%. That's not trying to push beyond what it is today or what other units are getting. So really being quite methodical and razor sharp about where do your rents are today stacking up against not only what you're getting in place from other, you know, comps in the area, but also how do you compete against, you know, the affordability aspect, which we're, you know, we're all obviously in the affordability game. And when you present that back to the you know, property managers, I'm like, look, here's a half a dozen units we can go and literally increase rents by $100 and spend no money, and we'll still keep below the 60% AMI. Let's go do that. Let's focus on that. And that's an infinite return. And that they're the little things that you have to be a bit more surgical about, rather than just like, oh, hi, Mr. Property Manager, hope you're doing your job right. And, you know, looking at how like we look at it. And that's the constant thing that when someone presents me a budget or someone presents me an expense, I'm like, well, how does this affect my overall NOI, and how do we offset it with more income? And having that conversation is the constant battle we always have at RSN. So
yeah, super, super helpful perspective and great points too, in terms of just the struggle right now to maintain and grow NOI. It's definitely a challenge right now. And I know you're thinking creatively about this. I know you're thinking about technology and artificial intelligence. How can you leverage that throughout operations to run more efficiently, to make your team more effective, to save on costs, on and so forth? And we ran into each other at the local IMN conference recently, and I know you spoke on a panel about this very topic. So on that panel discussion, I missed it, unfortunately, but were there any significant takeaways that you had, any golden nuggets that were talked about in that conversation? Anything you learned from that panel that you could share with us here today?
Yeah, look, I think I jokingly say I'm sassed out. I feel like it's where the gold mine, where the gold miners, we're panhandling, right? And we've got all these people, you know, selling us the shovels and the spades and the buckets, and they're making all the freaking money. And these are these SaaS companies. I just feel like I'm so sassed out right now. But there's also a real, real inefficiency. AI is like AI. It ain't going to solve your problems from an operations perspective like that. People are still mano a mano, particularly in the class C plus B minus space. Even in the class A space, you still need to have a warm body that someone can come and, excuse my language, bitch and moan to. Your tenant's going to come and complain about a leaky faucet. They don't want to just have an app that doesn't do it instantly, right? So I think there's AI tools that can help, but it's not this widespread, I'm going to reduce three people on site because I've got AI. I think it's more like I'm going to manage the people's time on site better by using AI tools. And as the owner, I need to understand where those dollars are being spent, because there are a lot of people out there going, my SaaS product's going to be the best thing since sliced bread. You should have another SaaS product. And so I think when we go down this path, it's always understanding what, you know, mundane tasks that you can get an AI bot to do are really, really good. Following up with text, automated emails, sending out reminders about delinquency, generating, you know, maybe monthly reports that are, you know, from your software system. But I'm still seeing a lot of inefficiencies. When I use four different property management companies, I use four different backend softwares. None of them speak to one another. So I'm trying to actually figure out right now, how can I create an AI tool that, you know, boils up all the P&Ls and the balance sheets to spit out portfolio level metrics that my asset managers has to do or my analyst has to do, which is very time consuming. It should be a click of the button type of stuff. So everything from asset management to property management is sort of in a very infant stage, but we're learning quickly. I think on the investor facing side, you know, all our content is helped with AI. Our newsletters help being generated by AI. So I think on the front-facing side, there's no excuse not to have good content that's going out there to attract investors. It's more from how do you get it into the management side, where it's still very mano a mano, dealing with tenants, dealing with vendors, dealing with property managers. And it's just that really fine line between spending too much and having a good return on investment. And that's what we always got to constantly keep asking, because I'm no expert in AI, and it's going to be completely different in 5 years than what it looks today. But I'm going to be bigger and ugly enough to know that I've got to go and start using it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Great perspectives there, Reid. As we start to kind of bring it home here today, one other last topic of conversation I'd like to cover with you here today is with our podcast, we've got a lot of real estate entrepreneurs who listen, a lot of people who are growing, whether it's their capital raising business, whether it's owner operators like yourself and like ASIM Capital, a lot of people who are building businesses out there in the world of real estate. And it's just super duper exciting. Now, that said, like I mentioned in the intro, you've built two different multifamily real estate private equity companies now. So I'd love to get your perspective here for folks out there who are kind of the emerging operators, if you will, who are building businesses. Do you have any words of advice in terms of, you know, building a team, you know, making sure that you build a profitable multifamily operations enterprise? You know, I think that oftentimes a mistake that people make is they might be afraid to ask for enough fees, right? And when it comes to this business, fees are important, right? You need acquisition fees, you need asset management fees. What kind of advice would you have for people out there to build a profitable, sustainable operating entity so that it's got longevity and it can kind of make it into the future?
Yeah, look, I'll say wholeheartedly that, like, I don't take a salary, right? So I'm all the fees that, you know, asset management, particularly asset management fees, construction management fees, those types of ongoing fees, they go back into pay for my staff. So in terms of profitability, I think profitability looks like sustainability. If you can have a portfolio that is sustainable and can be self-sustaining with the fees that are being generated, and then stuff like acquisition fees, that's the gravy that I can start to take. And then wait for those, you know, those oak trees to blossom in 5 or 6 years' time. That's how you've got to start looking at the business. So in the beginning, I was doing raising, the deck creation, the underwriting, the phone calls, the asset management, the construction management. I had to do it because I was the one-man band. You know, as you start to grow, there are very easy things and tasks that you can take off your plate. So as you're starting your business, I mentioned AI and content creation, there's very easy, inefficient ways and cheap ways to create good, thought-based knowledge content that can be very, very cheap. Also, underwriting deals. You know, like from day dot, I've always outsourced that to people overseas in India. Not that they do it for me, but they take it 90% of the way. And that's 90% more time than I don't have to do it, right? So I can come in and put my magic sauce on the top of it and say if it's a deal or not. And so just understanding what you're trying to build. Obviously, we're all trying to raise capital. We're all trying to attract eyeballs. And then as being on the operation side, it's also then building out your calluses on the hand as a good operator with time in the saddle. Right. And so there's no one magic bullet, what I'm trying to say, but understand that it's a sustainable growth and not just, you know, growing so quickly and hiring whoever you can without having the right, you know, fees to pay for it, because it can get very expensive very, very quickly. And in a time where there's not a lot of deal flow, well, how sustainable is that business? So it can be sustainable, it can be very profitable, but you've got to understand how to get it there. And I'm sure I could talk a whole podcast about the little, you know, things you can pull on and adjust here and there to you know, make stretch that dollar a long way, particularly when you're starting out.
That's awesome, Reed. We might have to have you back on the show here in a few months and go a bit deeper on that topic in another podcast episode with you. But this has been awesome, man. I really appreciate you coming on the show today and sharing all your knowledge and wisdom with us. If people want to follow you and what you've got going on at RSN Property Group, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, rsnpropertygroup.com. You can hit me up at reed@rsnpropertygroup.com, or you can just, you know, text me 323-519-1111. I'm in Los Angeles. Anyone who wants to come by, have a beer, have lunch, chew my ear off, let's do it. Love talking shop.
That's awesome, Reed. Again, thank you so much for your time today, man. Really, really appreciate it.